Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers. It's Richard Edelman. We are on the ground of the 2024 Cannes Lions International Festival of Creativity with Ested Herndon, national political reporter of the New York Times. And I gather also a Chicago guy.
Also a Chicago guy. Thanks for having me.
And he's host of The Run-Up, a guide to the 2024 U.S. presidential election. He also covered the 2020 presidential and the 2022 midterms for the New York Times. Yep. So welcome to Trustmakers. Glad to have you on this show. So, we've done our Trust Barometer special report on brands and politics.
Yeah.
And the biggest finding is that, in fact, politics is a core part of the marketing proposition.
Yeah.
That 60%+ of people vote with their wallets mm-hmm. on the basis of, you know, what they perceive to be a brand stands for. Mm-hmm. Did this surprise you?
No, it didn't surprise me. I was glad when you all did the study because when I looked at it, it really matched up with some of the things we see when we talk to people. I think a while ago, there was a sense that politics was a distant thing or maybe a private thing. You know, the kind of don't ask people what they do in the ballot box, a kind of uncomfortable question in the same way of religion or things like that. But that's definitely changed. I think over the last recent years, people see those things as personal and they see it as kind of core to your own value set. And that includes brands. And that has come up in a lot of activism over the last 4 or 5 years. And I think that obviously has shown up with some kind of consumer choices. We see different political groups kind of trying to target brands if they feel like their politics doesn't match up. And it's become a real strategy for some politicians and political parties to really target the kind of brand consumer level. And so it didn't surprise me because we've seen some of that play out. But the level of intensity that you all identified and the amount of people who feel like they expect brands to speak or act based on those values, the numbers of that were even higher than I expected.
It seemed to me that you had this activism on the left first,
mm-hmm.
and that's been for 15, 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been on DE&I, mm-hmm. it's been on sustainability issues, even geopolitics.
Yep.
Now it's from the right.
Absolutely. I think you see both sides really of the basis of those parties decide that they can shape the world or shape brands as they want to through that kind of activism. You mentioned on the left, I think certainly in kind of 2020, I remember the pressure for folks to speak up. There are these moments where I think because the traditional power structures have changed a lot of those grassroots level, a lot of those consumers who are in these different media ecosystems, they can choose a brand or choose a corporation to target and really kind of effectively shift what they expect politically from those groups of people. So I think at this point, we are in a new landscape where any brand or any corporation can find themselves in the crosshairs of kind of politics if they're not thinking about it proactively or thoughtfully.
One of the classic moves by business when there's a storm is to put your head down and wait for the storm to blow over.
Yeah.
But one of the big findings in the study is 60%+ of Gen Z, more than half people overall, say if a brand doesn't speak up, it's complicit.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think it depends, and I think the study spoke to this, about what is that brand's values, making sure that you're speaking to what folks expect you to. And so when that doesn't happen, when there's something that's happening in the news and a brand or a corporation is not actually leaning in, I do think consumers pick up on that and they look at that silence as an answer in itself. And so that's why I feel like the study was really naming really clearly is that if there is an expectation from your consumers that this is something that aligns with your brand values and then you're not acting, people are going to interpret that as an action within itself. And so I think that the lesson here is that folks who are leaders have to be proactive and have to see these kind of issues coming. And whether, you know, I don't think that means that we need corporations weighing in on every single political issue. But I do think it means that whether it's something locally or whether it's something that's specific to the product that they're offering, consumers are going to expect voice. And that has to be in the calculus now.
Were you surprised by the figures on nationalism where 80% or so of our respondents across 15 countries said, I will not buy products from a certain country if that company's headquartered there?
The number surprised me because I do think that wasn't in the air as we spoke 2 years ago. But the issue of geopolitics or foreign politics has become higher and higher on priority lists for even voters. I remember being at the Biden campaign headquarters 6 months ago and asking them these kind of questions. And their response was the historic answer was that, oh, we don't see people really prioritize non-domestic concerns like that. But that's changing a little. I think as the populace becomes more international, as our media becomes more globally interconnected, you're seeing that interest rise more for people. So it doesn't surprise me that if a corporation is headquartered a certain place, some consumers would hold them accountable. I think we've seen this in celebrity, people who hold concerts in certain places. I think there's been an expectation from some consumers that your values also have to match up when we get outside of the domestic borders. But that 80%, again, going back to the high number, that's what surprised me. The values seem true, but for something to be at that level of agreement, that means that's kind of universally believed.
Nationalism is expressed also in wanting to buy products from your own country.
Yes, absolutely.
And Republicans are in the 80s on wanting to buy products from America.
Yeah.
Do you see this?
Yeah, and I would actually say anecdotally, you know, this matches up with what we see when we travel across the country. If you go to a Republican event, if you go to a Trump rally, if I've gone to Trump rallies, there is a uniform of red, white, and blue. From the flag to the outfits to the music of him walking into Proud to Be an American by Lee Greenwood, there's a tone and tenor of that type of nationalism that the party has very frontally tried to make their own. And so when you see Republicans make that point about kind of buying domestically and expressing their nationalism through their consumer choices, that's because that value is in the party top down. They infuse that in every piece of their message. There's not a universal uniform if you go to a Biden event, right? But if you go to a Trump one, you better have on some of that flag. And so I think that is what we're seeing in those numbers, is that part is Republicans specifically have tried to make nationalism their own and encourage their voters to actually express that in value choices. One example I would give is on our podcast, we did an episode a couple years ago about something called Patriot Mobile, which is a company in Texas that is a cell phone company where a lot of conservatives use, and they will take a percentage of your bill and they donate it to conservative causes. And you'll see this at a lot of Republican events, at CPAC, at Trump rally. Patriot Mobile's everywhere. And it's one of these kind of niche things that I think not a lot of people know about, but speaks to the level of commitment that the right often has about expressing that nationalism. They say, I want to be aligned with a brand that is donating to those values, so much so that it's kind of a complete thing. You can watch kind of your TV, you can have even a cell phone company that's giving to those causes. And I think that's what that's speaking to.
And the overlap between brand and corporate reputation I found fascinating. The idea that it's price, quality, trust, and then shortly thereafter, what company made this product?
Yeah.
And so supply chain or fair pay for workers or all these things. Did that surprise you?
It does a little bit, because I think the issues with, you know, when we talk about fair pay, when we talk about where it's made, I think those are things that cut across party lines. And so I think years ago, we had a divide within our political system that was less class driven. And I think those things are becoming more top of mind now. So you hear political groups, politicians talk more about fair pay, talk more about workers, talk more about bottom up rather than top down. So I think those values are growing in terms of importance for people, which matches up with the study. It's not just about jobs by itself or where those jobs are, or thinking about even the kind of backlash against free trade that we've seen among some on the right specifically. It's all about those wages, and I think fair pay and where companies are headquartered are a part of that.
Did it surprise you that there was such a distinction between those issues that Democrats and Republicans want brands to be talking about? So, for example, a Democrat, if you talk about racism, for example, 61% of Democrats say, I'm more likely to buy that brand. Mm-hmm. It's different to Republicans who, if you're talking about work and how you can make it more efficient or something, people want that. So a Modelo campaign, for example, glorifying hardworking Latinos.
Yeah, I think it's indicative of one of the most important divides in our politics right now, which is a non-overlapping media silos for both of the parties. When we think about Democrats and Republicans right now, they're consuming different pieces of information. The values and policies that are at the top of priorities are vastly different. And there's oftentimes feels kind of like two ships in the night that aren't really interacting. And so I think that's reflective in the study in terms of what we see people most want to talk about. It's not racism on one side or anti-racism on another side. You know, it's completely completely different value sets. And I think that's reflective of the information bubbles that both those parties are in. I remember when Trump was elected for my job, I wanted to make sure I was ingesting the information as Republican voters saw him. And so I remember going on Facebook and joining all these groups and prioritizing Trump news on my feed so that when I logged on, it kind of felt like Trump supporters. And one of the things that was really helpful for me is it showed how distinct these worlds really are. And so as someone who lives in kind of New York Times, CNN ecosystem, you can sometimes feel a complete separation from what other people are mostly talking about. And so that manifests itself in those completely separate values that you're talking about.
And if you think of the regard for specific institutions, whether it's government or media, et cetera, you also have quite different views, DNR.
Absolutely. Definitely there's different views in terms of what those institutions, what's the role of those institutions. And I think this is expressed even in Biden and Trump. You know, Biden's actually promising a reinvestment in those things and is kind of pitching himself as a maintainer of those institutions, where I think, you know, Trump is pitching himself as a disruptor of those. And partially that's to seize on that distrust of those institutions. But what I think is unique about right now is when you go outside of the candidates or the top levels of the parties and to the bases or consumers, as we talk about in the brand and corporate sense, there's an agreement, I think, that some of those institutions aren't working, that there needs to be a rethinking about kind of how those function. And so while that seemed to be just the right-wing argument a couple years ago, I think increasingly the Democratic Party is dealing with portions of its base that are questioning how some institutions are run. And that's actually a big change over the last year. So I think when we think top down, there's a big difference between DNR and they view those roles. But when we think bottom up, I think there's an increasing agreement that some of those institutions are a little stale and there's a push to kind of rethink some of those.
And if you look at the effect of COVID on trust in institutions and trust in the executive branch and some of the agencies, I mean, there was a fantastic editorial in last Sunday's Times by one of your journalists about having lived through COVID and the effect of Dr. Fauci acknowledging that, in fact, the 6-foot distancing was his best guess, or the effect of masking or any of these things, which had a corrosive effect. So what's the impact on brands, therefore?
I think you're identifying something that was really important and that I think we're just really coming to terms with how that's affecting things both politically and on a brand level. You mentioned the Fauci example. I can say when we travel across the country, COVID is a breaking point for a lot of people. They feel like they put trust in some institutions. And I think the response is like, oh, I think they knew a little less than they were presenting at the time. In fact, I was at a Robert F. Kennedy Jr. rally in Michigan, who's obviously someone who's made his whole political brand and now is running third party as a disruptor of institutions and sowing distrust specifically on vaccines and COVID. And the unique thing there was that you had people in the audience who voted for Trump 4 years ago, voted for Biden 4 years ago, and were kind of coming together on their shared distrust. And that's a real live ball for this year, because I don't really know how that develops in terms of people expressing that distrust. They're expressing their upsetness with kind of COVID disruption. But I can definitely agree that it's in the air. So I'm kind of skirting the question because I don't know how that is going to affect on the brand level or the political level. But I can certainly say that when we talk to people, they express that that was kind of a breaking point for them. And I think it's really going to matter both in election and when we think about the ways brands and consumers live going forward.
The way we've looked at trust is historically it was conveyed top down from establishment figures.
Yeah.
That started to erode 20 years ago. Then it went to horizontal, to peer-to-peer, and that started to erode with disinformation. And now trust is local. In my company, my CEO, my company newsletter is more believed than the mainstream media. But this is a key development.
Absolutely. You know, I was walking past here and, you know, there was a sign that says behind every consumer decision, there's a creator someone trusts. That's type of that hyper-local brand building that you're talking about here. And that's a big shift. I think Gen Z is a generation that really believes they have access to information in a different way. They trust themselves or individual people, to your point, to relay that information. And they feel themselves as backlashing against kind of corporatized versions of that. And so I think that that has a lot of danger to it, you know, but I also think we have to respond to that from a media institution, from a media lens, from a journalistic lens, from a brand lens. And so our response has been making sure that we aren't like the stereotype that they expect from us. And so I think it's a lot easier to blow off a stuffy New York Times reporter in your head than a person who is there in your community asking you about what you care about and doing it locally, to your point. And I think that's where that trust has to be rebuilt. You know, we've lost local newspapers. We've lost local media institutions that were doing a lot of that work before. And so some of us in these high, lofty places have to bring ourselves there so that we can repair some of that has been lost.
I also want to talk about multinationals selling brands across 100 plus countries in the world. Mm-hmm. One of the things in this study that was evident is the possibility of local brands being important,
yeah,
because they identify with local values, yep, and all that. What's your observation on how to be local?
Yeah, that's a good question. For our work, we are often going into a community there for a short period of time and then having to ask ourselves to reflect those values, which can be derided as flyover journalism or things like that. But I think we're frankly asking the question that you're asking me right now, which is how do you authentically make yourself local from a New York Times level, from a multinational level? I think you have to know what you don't know. For us, when we are those places, I'm not trying to tell a story that says everything about this community or says everything about this person. I have to know that I cannot achieve that goal. And I think part of that recognition allows you to be more confident about the things that you can learn. And I often find that you need to engage those local stakeholders in the story and ask them, what do people usually miss about this place? How do people get the story wrong? And it's very important to me that when we go places, the people who are most invested, who live there day to day, feel like they can still identify with it. So we were just in Arizona covering the possible impact of abortion rights on how they might vote in the state and its effect possibly on the presidential election. And one thing that's key is that when that episode comes out, someone texts me, this field, I've recognized my state in this, both the good and the bad parts. Those, that to me means we are accomplishing that kind of local goal. But that only happens if that is a priority from the start. If you get there, you do what you do every single place and then put something out, I think you'll miss those authenticity points. And so I actually have to make it a priority that we reach out to people at the beginning, learn the pitfalls people make consistently, and then try to make sure that we avoid them.
When Caitlin Clark wasn't picked for the U.S. Women's basketball team, there was a big backlash on, yep, social media saying, well, of course she wasn't picked because she's a white ball player, or we don't. And Caitlin Clark was very quick to stamp that.
Yeah.
And make sure that, look, 4 years from now, I'm going to compete my best to get on the team, yep, and, you know, I don't deserve it yet.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really good lesson for brands. What did you see?
She's been so clear-eyed about her role as a basketball player and about staying out of the noise around it. And I think that that's been important for her as this conversation has developed. But I see such a media, a disrupted, kind of fragmented media ecosystem who is using that name and using the controversy around it to drive clicks and interest at the detriment of the WNBA. And so I think that it's been important for her, it's been important for others, and it's been important for people who are invested in that league success to kind of stump that out. But me as a consumer, I got into the WNBA like 4 years ago. I was like an NBA person who, like, when the Sky were doing better, started watching. And I could feel the lack of storytelling and investment around the league, right? I know that in basketball, if I'm watching NBA finals, I'm not just showing up for one player. I know 10 storylines, and they're telling me 10 storylines that are getting me invested. The WNBA has not had that level of storytelling investment from media, from even the league itself. And so what I think we're seeing now is some of those growing pains where people are putting so much on one individual person, but not really giving us the diversity of storylines that are in this place, many of which would include Caitlin Clark. But to your point, she has not allowed that to consume her. And I think that's been really important, is that every time you hear her talk about it, it's very focused on, I'm not involving myself in the rest of that, and I'm staying like clear-eyed as a player. And to the brand level, that's what drives everything else, you know? If she's good on the court, all the rest of the stuff will happen. And so I think that level of clarity is important.
Our basic thesis for this report is your brand, my politics. Mm-hmm. And that balancing of how you incorporate politics into your marketing plans. Again, as a person reflecting on the upcoming U.S. election, the, yeah, UK election, July 4th, funny, and the recent ones in Mexico, India, if you're a brand leader, what should you be reflecting?
It's hard because I think that to the point about the differences between all of those elections locally is important, but there's also a universal thing. I think we've seen kind of anti-incumbent backlash. I think we've seen people upset with inflation and wages and things like that. And I think we've seen people, to the point about distrust in institutions, expressed that politically over the last year or so in the COVID backlash way. I think that there is some backlash even to the DEI 2020 moment, where people feel like they were being told a very specific way of how to express their values, and some of that is unraveling. So all of those things are kind of consistent themes that we see. But I think if you are a brand, there's a majority of people who believe that things aren't working the way that they should, right? There's a majority of people who believe that the parties, at least domestically in the U.S., are not reflective of their values, that believe they're being pulled to extremes, you know, that are more interested in things that folks agree on than separate. And so those are types of things I think corporations can speak to. And that system distrust, I've always found that it builds trust with people when you acknowledge that. When you affirm the fact that they might be skeptical of the political system. I think that's a very natural thought to have right now. And so for us, and I think it's true for journalists, I think it's true for brands largely, you don't have to run from that. You can acknowledge the way people feel about that, help explain to them how things got this way, or try to think about other things that exist outside of that. And I think people really see and respect that, because there's such an incentive to pretend, like, to I think kind of gaslight that feeling. There's such an incentive to tell people, oh, you shouldn't, like, just yell at them to vote, or yell at them that it matters. And I don't think that's really how you build trust. I think you actually can acknowledge why people are distrustful and then go a different place. But starting there, I think, is a thing that all brands can do and actually helps build trust.
For me, the most important function of a brand at this moment is to bring optimism, because we are going into elections so down.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to say, okay, here's hope. Here's what can be.
Yeah.
And inspiration.
Yeah.
And
I think we're saying the same thing, because I view speaking to that distrust as kind of hopeful. You know, I actually think that when I meet voters who are like, I don't care about this election. I don't want to deal with any of this stuff. It's too depressing. I'll say, explain to me why. Tell me why you feel like that. And we actually end up usually having a very good conversation about the reasons they feel distant from that process. And so a lot of times we see, and this is true in some of the reporting, that when people acknowledge distrust, it can build optimism. It's that oftentimes it feels as if no one's actually affirming how they feel before they can make that next step. And so I do definitely think that it's important for both journalists and brands, or people who exist outside of that political system, to play a role that can get people to move to a place that's more optimistic. But I don't think you can do that without feeling like you're speaking in an authentic and honest voice. And I think that that's what a lot of consumers, and I would say grassroots voters in our language, are looking for. They're looking for authenticity. They're looking for that honesty. Then they're willing to be moved.
Yeah, somewhere between the brand's values and what the stakeholders expect. So one of the canards in the last month has been that purpose is dead, and that smart brands will be much more about function and delivering value, and I think that's just fake news, and that's very politicized. What do you see?
I hadn't heard that, but I would agree with you, because I don't think purpose is dead. I think people are stepping back from that being the biggest pitch, which I just think means people who have a clear-eyed purpose stand out more. And so what is that purpose? Are you following through on it, and it is aligned with your brand? That's a big question. But is purpose dead? I don't think so. But I do think people are stepping back. I do think purpose was like super cool a couple years ago, and that some people have stepped back from that because maybe it seemed like there had more pitfalls in it than they expected. But that was always true. It was never going to be like an easy thing to like have a brand that's purpose aligned. But I don't think that that means that people don't want it anymore. I really think people want the authentic versions of purpose. And that's the big distinction.
That's why we say trust drives growth and action earns trust.
Yeah.
So let me wrap it there. Thank you so much for being on this Trustmakers episode, and I'll see you at the convention in Chicago 50 years after 60. It's crazy.
We'll remember this calm, nice time here as we're in the chaos of the Chicago. But thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure.
I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you for tuning into the Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.